Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 107. It's Monday, March 29th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, everybody in Ohio age 16 plus is eligible for a COVID-19 vaccination, so take advantage of that. The only limitation is that if you're 16 or 17 years old, you're going to need to get the Pfizer vaccine because that's the only one approved for 16 and 17 year olds. The other ones are for 18 and above. Okay, well, one, just stepping back and taking a look at this epidemic or epidemics, as the case may be. Cases have been rising here locally and to the north in Michigan. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But one thing I wanted to point out is that, for instance, this week in Lucas County, we're moved up to like 100 new cases on average per day. But with variants on the rise and the original wild virus on the decline, we're seeing kind of a switch out. So case for case, we're actually getting more with the variants that are more infectious and more deadly. So 100 cases where you have more of the deadly variants is worse than having 100 cases of the original wild type virus. So just to point out, this is one of the reasons why our CDC director is getting very nervous, because we're seeing trends all over the country as we're opening up more. And even with vaccinations increasing, we're seeing rates rise. And this could be, we're seeing increases in hospitalizations as well. So it's not just infections, it's actually serious disease. But of course, with vaccinations, you can vastly decrease both infection rates and serious disease. So let's start with some news. This from Science Daily. Benefit of early vaccination on healthcare workforce. Vaccinating healthcare workers resulted in an immediate and notable reduction of positive COVID-19 cases among employees, reducing the number of required isolations and quarantines by more than 90%, according to data at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Woohoo! Vaccinations work! And another study from the CDC, the MMWR, their flagship publication, Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report, interim estimates of vaccine effectiveness of mRNA vaccines in preventing SARS-CoV-2 infection among healthcare personnel, first responders, and other essential and frontline workers in 8 U.S. locations, data from December 20th through March 21st. Prospective cohorts of 3,950 healthcare personnel, first responders, and other essential and frontline workers completed weekly testing for 13 consecutive weeks. Under real-world conditions, the mRNA vaccine effectiveness of full immunization, that is 14 or more days after the second dose, was 90% effective against SARS-CoV-2 infections, regardless of symptom status. Vaccine effectiveness of partial immunization, that is 14 or more days after the first dose, but before the second dose, was still 80% effective. Way to go. And of course, the mRNA vaccines are the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And more good news for the mRNA vaccinations. This is from Medical Express. Research shows mRNA vaccination is safe and effective even with chronic inflammatory diseases. Chronic inflammatory diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, or chronic inflammatory bowel disease are autoimmune diseases in which the immune system targets the body. This leads to misdirected inflammations in the body, which flare up repeatedly. Many of the diseases are therefore kept under control with immunosuppressive therapy. That is a form of treatment that suppresses the immune response. People undergoing immunosuppressive therapy were excluded from the clinical trials for approval of the new mRNA vaccines against COVID-19. There's therefore been no data available to date on how the vaccination works in this particular group, what the side effects are, and whether they can possibly lead to new flares of infection. Well, a Kiel research team from the Cluster of Excellence Precision Medicine and Chronic Inflammation has investigated this and published the results now in the scientific journal Annals of the Rheumatic Diseases. The researchers show for the first time worldwide that the new mRNA vaccines against COVID-19 are effective and well-tolerated for people with chronic inflammatory diseases and undergoing immunosuppressive therapy. Vaccination with one of the mRNA vaccines did not lead to any disease activity in the patients in our study, and we could not detect any flares of inflammation by either clinical or molecular methods, said Dr. Ulf Geisen, first author of the study. In addition, neither different nor more frequent side effects were observed in the group with chronic inflammatory diseases than in the control group or in the clinical trials for approval. In fact, no person in this group developed a fever, whereas a symptom occurred in some of the healthy participants. All people undergoing immunosuppressive therapy also showed a sufficient vaccine response to the vaccines. Good news. Okay, well, hopefully the vast majority of people will get vaccinated and we can achieve herd immunity in the U.S. population. And of course, we're going to need to do that quite thoroughly throughout the entire country, not just in some places, to really beat this virus back down. And one of the concerns, looking in the long view of where we might be some months from now, this story from Medical Express deals with the issue of coronavirus reinfections. So frequent seasonal coronavirus reinfections hints at possibility of endemic COVID-19, and that means persistent in the population versus an epidemic, which is a large increase. Okay, reinfections of seasonal coronaviruses are frequent, according to a new research that suggests that the coronavirus behind the current pandemic could also produce reinfections. The study by researchers at the University of Michigan School of Public Health and collaborators at the National Institute of Health and National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases is published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. There's a hint that there could be SARS-CoV-2 reinfections in the future, whether that's because enough time has passed that your immunity has dropped off or the virus has changed enough that it can escape your immune system. The first author, Joshua Petrie, research assistant professor at the U of M Department of Epidemiology. The frequency of reinfections with the different seasonal coronaviruses suggests that SARS-CoV-2 is not going to completely disappear. Petrie and colleagues used data from the household influenza vaccine evaluation from 2010 to 2018, which included over 3,400 individuals. Researchers identified over 1,000 seasonal coronavirus infections. Of those, 30% were reinfections, and 5% were co-infections with more than one type of coronavirus at the same time. Of the reinfections, 27% occurred within a year of the original infection, a relatively short period given their seasonality. While researchers have studied previous flu pandemics to understand and prepare for potential outbreaks, the current pandemic is the first documented to be caused by a coronavirus, said senior author Arnold Monto, professor of epidemiology at U of M School of Public Health. We can't say that it is true that these coronaviruses will apply to the novel SARS-CoV-2 virus, but these infections have been in our population for years, and they may give us a clue on what we can expect with COVID-19 going forward, said Monto, an internationally known expert on outbreak response and pandemic planning, including transmission modes. And as my regular listeners will note, last week I reported a couple stories documenting that actually reinfection by COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, is actually not that uncommon and can occur in a matter of months, which kind of confirms what's alluded to here, that even with the seasonality, in other words, like a winter period for most coronaviruses that produce some of the common cold, that you could actually get infected at the beginning of the season and then lose your immunity and get reinfected by the end of the season. Just another friendly reminder that if you've been infected, it doesn't mean that you are protected from reinfection. And also to a reminder that the immunity that's developed from the vaccines is way stronger than that developed by being exposed to the virus itself.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get to the local update. But to provide some context, I want to start actually with Michigan. Because as you folks might remember, in the first wave, the original wave of this pandemic, the wave really came down from Michigan into Ohio. And obviously, we're right in the way of that. Well, it looks like that may be repeating itself as Michigan as a whole, but particularly the Thumb and Southeast Michigan is getting hard hit now. And that's also the area with the so-called UK variant, which is more infectious and more deadly. So this from MichiganLive.com, MLive.com. Michigan sees alarming increase in COVID-19 hospitalizations among unvaccinated adults. Michigan is seeing an alarming increase in hospitalizations among younger adults who are less likely to be vaccinated, says the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. The increases are being driven by younger adults. Since March 1st, hospitalizations increased by 633% for adults aged 30 to 39 and by 800% for adults aged 40 to 49, according to inpatient data collected by the Michigan Hospital Association. Meanwhile, hospitalizations for those 80 and older are up 37%. About 44% of Michiganders in that oldest age group are fully vaccinated, and more than two-thirds have had at least one dose. Michigan is making progress at ultimately defeating the COVID-19 pandemic through increasing vaccination rates, but the war is not over yet, said Dr. Kerry Roth, the chief medical officer of the Michigan Health Hospital Association. Now is not the time to let our guard down and risk contracting COVID-19, with more contagious variants emerging and vaccines becoming widely available. My prescription to all Michiganders is to wear your mask, wash your hands, avoid crowds, and when it's your turn, get your vaccine. You must continue to take preventive measures even if you're vaccinated, because it takes at least 2 weeks for vaccine's full protection to kick in following the last dose, and it will take time to vaccinate everyone. And another Michigan story from Medical Express. Michigan sees virus surge, but tighter restrictions unlikely. Michigan, which not long ago had one of the country's lowest COVID-19 infection rates, is confronting an alarming spike that some experts worry could be a harbinger nationally. In what public health authorities across the U.S. have been warning for months might happen around the country, the resurgence is being fueled by loosened restrictions, a more infectious variant, and pandemic fatigue. While vaccinations in Michigan are helping to protect senior citizens and other vulnerable people, the upswing is driving up hospitalizations among younger adults and threatening in-person instruction at schools. It's a stark reminder that this virus is still very real. It can come roaring back if we drop our guard, said Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who does not plan to tighten restrictions on indoor dining, sports, and other activities that were eased in recent months. Whitmer contended at a Michigan Chronicle event that this surge is different from last fall and spring, in part because of the vaccine, which has been given to nearly two-thirds of residents 65 and older, those most at risk of dying. COVID-19 hospitalizations, though higher in recent weeks, remain below the peak of December. And I looked up the data, just a little update on Wayne County, which is the county that Detroit is in. In the last week, they've had a 65% increase in cases and a 76% increase in hospitalization. So this is not just infections that aren't resulting in severe disease. Severe disease is ramping back up in Michigan. Okay, and back to Ohio news. This from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio lawmakers override Governor Mike DeWine's veto of health order bill. Ohio lawmakers rejected Governor Mike DeWine's last-minute offer, voting instead to override his veto of a bill that would change how health orders work. The law will let lawmakers reject or modify any state health order as soon as it is given and let the legislature extend or end states of emergencies. The bill takes effect in 90 days. Well, this is a weakening, obviously, of the governor's ability to do health orders. And obviously, even as a Republican governor, the Republican legislature has been very antithetical to a lot of his attempts and want to limit his ability to put in public health orders. Not good news, in my opinion. Okay, well, let's get back to the local data. The Lucas County average of daily cases over the past week bumped up to 100, back to triple digits here, people. That's up from 69 the week before. We had been going down and staying sort of even, but like last week when I was looking at the data, I was thinking I saw a little uptick here, and that's what we're seeing some places nationally. That's consistent. And as another reminder, 64 of Ohio's 88 counties are still considered high incidence. That is one less in the high category than last week, but still, most of the state is high incidence. And another bad news for Lucas County, the testing positivity rate, that's the proportion, the percent of people who get tested that test positive, bumped up to 8.1%. That from 6.6%, a pretty significant bump from the week before. And we had almost gotten down to the 5% rate, which is considered adequate testing a few weeks ago, but we're back on the incline again. And Ohio, which has a lower positivity rate of 3.5%, that also has gone up the last couple weeks from a low of 3% a couple weeks ago. So it looks like we're ticking back up, people. Time to start taking this a little more seriously again. It is not over. Okay. Well, in nursing homes in Lucas County, we had 12 active cases, that's 2 residents and 10 staff, and that's up from what it's been the last few weeks, but it's still at a pretty low level historically. So it seems to parallel the fact that we're seeing a tick up out in the community. We're seeing a parallel tick up in the nursing homes. Okay, new hospitalizations have increased 50% in Lucas County in the last week. Not a good trend, and the trend in Ohio is up slightly in the last week as well. Fortunately, the Lucas County death rate has held down over the last 14 days with only 12 deaths, and this rate is actually lower than the state and national death rates. Although I'm still not completely sure if the Ohio death reporting system is totally back up to normal, but we'll take that as good news. Okay, UT, after a record low 5 cases last week, identified 12, and after hitting a record low 0% positivity from their surveillance testing, they're up to a 0.6% positivity, which is up what they were a few weeks before last week's record. So probably not of huge concern, but a little bit of a tick up there. And this from WTVG, University of Toledo holding COVID-19 vaccine clinics. The University of Toledo will hold 2 vaccine clinics exclusively for the UT community in the coming weeks. It's an opportunity for faculty, staff, and students age 18 and older to get a shot. Appointments for the first clinic on April 1st are already full, but the university will send invitations out this week about available shots for another clinic on April 5th. Appointments will be booked on a first-come, first-served basis. The university says it plans to hold additional clinics as more vaccine supply, becomes available in an effort to return to traditional campus life. Okay, well, the race to get vaccinated is continuing. And those people with at least one dose, 94 million in the U.S. at 28%. We've seen similar levels and rates In the state and Lucas County, 3.3 million in Ohio have received at least their first dose, and 117,000 in Lucas County at 27%. We've lost our lead of being ahead of the game in Ohio and U.S. over the last couple of weeks, but it looks like it's running neck to neck here, very similar between the state, national, and local vaccination rates. But I have added tracking the racial ethnic disparities, looking at the likelihood of a Black person in Lucas County being vaccinated as a white person in Lucas County. And a Lucas County Black is 46% as likely to be vaccinated as a white person in Lucas County. That is up a shocking 1% from 45% the first couple weeks before. So it doesn't seem to be really changing much. If this is actually an improvement, it is way too slow and way, way, way too inadequate. I'm going to call this one a fail. About a month ago, they had a nice rollout of an equity program to make sure to get a certain amount of doses into racial ethnic minority communities. It's hard to say that's making much difference. It goes back to the fact that we've opened it up to everybody, and those with the easiest access, which of course is not those that have been traditionally disenfranchised. So the race means those fastest first will get there, and leaves back those that have traditionally been left behind. In Ohio, it's slightly better, 52% as likely as a white person for a Black person to have been vaccinated, and that's moved up 3 whole points in the last couple of weeks. Oh boy. And more news on this front from the Kaiser Family Foundation, latest data on COVID-19 vaccinations by race and ethnicity. As of March 15th, 2021, CDC reported that race, ethnicity was known for just over half, or 53% of people who received at least one dose of the vaccine. However, to date, CDC is not providing state-level demographic data for people vaccinated. The state is providing that, but this just goes to show that nationwide, we are doing a crummy job of even collecting data by race, ethnicity, let alone making real-world efforts to make sure that these racial ethnic disparities are removed. More bad news. Okay, folks, you Ohioans, you Buckeyes, you can get vaccinated now if you're 16 or plus. The easiest way to do it is go to gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. That's gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. And you can find out where it's available and actually make appointments right online. If you want to get some local help, you can call 211 for language assistance, or if you have poor internet access, you can call, for those over age 65, you can call the Area Office of Aging at 419-382-0624, or Lucas County residents can visit any library branch to schedule an appointment, or call 419-259-5200. This is Just for the Health of It. WAKT, We Act Radio, 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And I give you this personal guarantee, if you listen to this show for an entire year, you'll know more about public health than over 99% of the population. Boom! The only tuition is your time and interest. Okay, let's look at some more vaccination news. This from Medical Express. Rutgers to require students be vaccinated for virus in fall. Rutgers University will require that all students be vaccinated for the coronavirus before arriving for classes in the fall. The university said students may request an exemption from vaccination for medical or religious reasons. Students participating in online-only classes will not be required to be vaccinated. Rutgers said it has received approval from the state of New Jersey to administer vaccines on campus to faculty, staff, and students once vaccine supplies are available to the university. And others have reported in quick surveys of Ohio universities and other universities that most people are encouraging it, but not a lot are requiring it. But this seems to be a trend. Look forward to the vaccination wars as far as what you can and cannot do in society. And on that front, this from the Hill. New York launches nation's first, quote, vaccine passport. New York has become the first state to launch a so-called vaccine passport that can be used to get into certain venues, called an Excelsior Pass, the passport will be available in a phone app in the form of a QR code that can be scanned to prove the owner has been vaccinated. The pass will be used at entertainment venues and can allow for increased crowd sizes for events such as weddings. Other countries, including Denmark, have already begun implementing their own vaccine passports. The app for New York is being funded by the state and was built on IBM's Digital Health Pass platform. Bum, 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 bum. So it begins. And I want to highlight at this point another feature on this show, bonus articles that I post online that you can read at your leisure. This bonus article that's available this week is the so-called vaccine passports are on the way, but developing them won't be easy. So if you want to learn about more vaccine passports, go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Okay, well, this is a pandemic, meaning it's worldwide. So this from the Hill. World Health Organization asks rich countries to donate 10 million vaccine doses to poorer ones. The World Health Organization asked rich countries to donate 10 million coronavirus vaccine doses to poorer nations. COVAX is ready to deliver, but we can't deliver vaccines we don't have. Bilateral deals, export bans, and vaccine nationalism have caused distortions in the market with gross inequities in supply and demand, the World Health Organization director said at a press conference. 10 million doses is not much, and it's not nearly enough. Poor countries have struggled with obtaining the vaccine. Richer ones, such as the United States, China, and others, have been able to vaccinate millions of citizens in order to curb the coronavirus. The U.S. has signaled it will not be sending vaccines to most other countries until every American is able to be vaccinated, though the Biden administration has announced a deal to share with its neighbors, Canada and Mexico. The president has made it clear that he is focused on ensuring that vaccines are accessible to every American. This is our focus, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said at a press briefing towards the beginning of March. The next step is economic recovery and ensuring that our neighbors Mexico and Canada have similarly managed the pandemic so we can open our borders and build back better. Countries in the European Union, meanwhile, have come under fire for their slow vaccination rollout. It is unclear what countries, if any, might respond to the World Health Organization's call for donations. And in a related story, also from The Hill, progressives up pressure on Biden to back COVID vaccine patent waiver. Progressives are increasing pressure on President Biden to support a waiver for COVID-19 vaccine patent protections at the World Trade Organization, arguing the move is crucial for helping lower-income countries fight the coronavirus. The push features leading Democratic lawmakers and advocacy groups calling on Biden to take action, but the White House has not made clear its position. At issue is a proposal before the World Trade Organization, led by India and South Africa, and backed by more than 50 other countries, to waive intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines. Proponents argue it would enable lower-income countries to ramp up their own manufacturing and help address severe shortages outside of the richest countries and benefit every country by cutting down on the ability of new variants to develop as the virus spreads. The effort is also backed by a wide array of outside groups, including Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, and Partners in Health. The Director General of the World Health Organization also backed the idea in a Guardian op-ed this month. Of the 225 million vaccine doses that have been administered so far, the vast majority have been in a handful of rich and vaccine-producing countries, while most low- and middle-income countries watch and wait. Experts say Americans are at danger, too, if the virus continues to spread in other parts of the world, given that new, dangerous variants can develop. Mindful of COVID variants from Brazil and South Africa, to stop this deadly virus, we need widespread immunization everywhere around the globe, not just in the wealthiest countries. Okay, another vaccination news, this from Medical Express. HPV infections are plummeting due to widespread vaccination. 15 years of widespread vaccination of U.S. children with the human papilloma HPV vaccine is reaping big rewards. A more than 80% drop in new infections has been seen in women and girls under the age of 25. That could mean an equally big drop to come in a host of dangerous conditions that are linked to HPV infection, including cancers of the cervix, anogenital area, and the mouth and throat, as well as anogenital warts. What's more, a hoped-for herd immunity appears to have set in, so that the benefits of HPV vaccination are extending to women who never got the shot, according to researchers at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Certain strains of sexually transmitted HPV are thought to be the leading cause of cervical cancers. The first vaccine aimed at warding off infection was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2006, and it was targeted to four strains of the virus. In 2015, a vaccine that targeted five additional strains was approved, and these, quote, nine-valent shots have been the standard since 2016. Current CDC recommendations are that girls and boys age 11 to 12 receive HPV vaccination, and catch-up vaccinations are recommended for women through the age of 26. Good news on the power of vaccines. Okay, well, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about food and health. This from the Food Politics blog written by Marion Nessel. I've just had a book review published in the American Journal of Public Health. Public Health Nutrition Deserves More Attention. It's for a textbook on public health nutrition, but doing it gave me the opportunity to say some things I want public health professionals to know. I started the review like this. Food and nutrition deserve much more attention from public health professionals. On the grounds of prevalence alone, diet-related conditions affect enormous numbers of people. Everybody eats. Everybody is at risk of eating too little for health or survival, or too much to the point of weight gain, an increased prevalence of non-communicable diseases. By the latest count, nearly 700 million people in the world do not get enough to eat on a daily basis, a number that has increased by tens of millions over the past 5 years and will surely increase by many millions more as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. At the same time, about 2 billion adults are overweight or obese, and few countries are prepared to deal with the resulting onslaught of type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Beyond that, food production, distribution, consumption, and disposal, collectively food systems, are responsible for a quarter or more of greenhouse gas emissions. Climate change affects the health of everyone on the planet. The same social, behavioral, economic, and structural determinants that affect health also affect nutritional health, and it is no accident that food choices are flashpoints for arguments about culture, identity, social class, inequity, and power, as well as the role of government, private enterprise, and civil society in food systems. From a public health standpoint, everyone, regardless of income, class, race, gender, or age, should have the power to choose diets that meet nutritional needs, promote health and longevity, protect the environment, and are affordable, culturally appropriate, and delicious. For people in high-income countries, dietary prescriptions for health and sustainability advise eating less meat but more foods from plant sources. Optimal diets should minimize consumption of ultra-processed foods. Those that are industrially produced, bear little resemblance to the basic foods from which they are derived, cannot be prepared in home kitchens, and are now compellingly associated with non-communicable disease risk and mortality. We now know that ultra-processed foods encourage people to unwittingly take in more calories and gain weight. Today, a book for researchers and practitioners of public health nutrition needs to emphasize coordinated, triple-duty recommendations and interventions to deal with hunger and food insecurity, obesity, and its consequences, and the effects of food production and dietary choices on the environment. Such approaches, as described by a Lancet commission early in 2019, should encourage populations of high-income countries to eat less meat but more vegetables, those in lower and middle-income countries to consume a greater variety of foods, and everyone, everywhere, to reduce intake of ultra-processed foods. As that commission argued, public health nutritionists must recognize that attempts to improve diets, nutritional status, nutritional inequities, and food systems face daunting barriers from governments captured by corporations, civil society too weak to demand more democratic institutions, and food companies granted far too much power to prioritize profits at the expense of public health. Nutritionists need knowledge and the tools to resist food company marketing and lobbying, to advocate for regulatory controls of those practices, and to promote civil society actions to demand healthier and more sustainable food systems. Well, thank you for that commentary. Okay, well, sticking to the theme of food and health, but taking a little bit more practical approach, this from Medical Express. Seven healthy strategies to navigate a food swamp. On nearly every corner and along the roads in between, the familiar signs comfort and tempt us. Burgers and fried chicken, ice cream and donuts, sweets and treats galore. Welcome to the food swamp, where Americans get bogged down in a morass of cheap, convenient, alluring, and very often unhealthy culinary choices. All these fast food companies with all their marketing are competing for our stomach space and our dollars, said Penny Chris Etherton, distinguished professor of nutrition at Penn State University. It's hard to make healthy choices when there's so many odds against you. The term food swamp was coined about a decade ago to denote areas where fast food chains and convenience stores abound, swamping healthier options such as grocery stores and restaurants with wider choices. They often coincide with food deserts, where a lack of convenient or low-cost supermarkets makes it harder to get fresh produce and nutritious food. That combination all too often occurs in low-income and under-resourced neighborhoods, said Kristen Cooksey Stowers, an assistant professor at the University of Connecticut who specializes in health equity and food-related public policy. It's not that fast food or corner stores are inherently bad, she said, but when it becomes the majority of what a neighborhood can rely on, that's a problem. We see areas inundated with unhealthy food. Cooksey Stowers' research has shown a correlation between food swamps and obesity, and she led a 2017 study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health showing food swamps were a better predictor of obesity than food deserts. Chris Etherton was chief author of an article last year in the Journal of the American Heart Association linking food swamps and food deserts to poor diet quality, obesity, and cardiovascular disease, all of which can be more prevalent among low-income people, many of whom are Black and Hispanic and other people of color. The authors call for policy changes to address the disparities. In the long term, Cooksey Stowers said solutions include better zoning to limit clusters of fast food outlets, incentives to build grocery stores and farmer markets in disadvantaged areas, and even requiring convenience stores to stock a certain percentage of healthy food. People need to realize that they are empowered to be part of the change in their community, she said. In the meantime, if you're hungry, keep this in mind. These are the 7 suggestions. 1. Carry a healthy snack. An apple, carrot sticks, or some nuts in the car might keep you from overdoing it at the drive-thru. Take something with you so you don't really get hungry. When you're really hungry, you eat more. Next, be wary of bargains. We're all value-minded, Chris Etherton said. You see supersizes or buy one, get one free. Maybe that makes sense if you're with somebody, but not if you're by yourself. Beware of beverages. Sugary sodas and coffee concoctions packed with flavors and cream have more calories than an entree. People don't think of it as something they're eating, she said. They think, it's a drink. I don't have to count it. Well, they do. Pay attention to the extras. Mayonnaise on that burger or sub sandwich adds calories and fat. Ask for extra lettuce and tomato instead. So does the whipped cream stacked atop the coffee. Doing without them is a small step, but is a very good first step, Chris Etherton said. So what if they're open late? There are brands trying to create the fourth meal of the day with all those late night hours, Cooksey Stowers said. You know that's terrible for the body. Stick with no more than 3 meals a day. Make a plan and stick to it. Check out the menu and choose healthy options, like salads and grilled chicken instead of fried. And if you can use the drive-thru, don't go in, so you're not tempted by seeing everybody eating burgers and fries with large sodas. Fries are okay on occasion, but buy the small size or share an order with someone. Just say go. If you can, keep driving or stay on that bus to get to the supermarket instead of stopping off for the fast food. These are things that people know. We just have to eat less of the unhealthy stuff. Okay, and switching gears again a bit, let's talk about environmental health. This from Science Daily. Researchers call for revisions to air quality monitoring guidelines to consider the sources of emissions. Researchers at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at University of California, San Diego, examining 14 years of hospital emission data, conclude that the fine particles in wildfire smoke can be several times more harmful to human respiratory health than particulate matter from other sources, such as car exhaust. While this distinction has been previously identified in laboratory experiments, the new study confirms it at the population level. This new research work focused on Southern California reveals the risks of tiny airborne particles with diameters of up to 2.5 microns, about 1/20th of that of a human hair. These particles, termed PM2.5, are the main component of wildfire smoke and can penetrate the human respiratory tract, enter the bloodstream, and impair vital organs. A 10 microgram per cubic meter increase in PM2.5 attributed to sources other than wildfire smoke was estimated to increase respiratory hospital emissions by 1%. The same time, when attributed to wildfire smoke, caused between a 1.3 to 10% increase in respiratory emissions. There is a daily threshold for the amount of PM2.5 in the air that is considered acceptable by the county and the Environmental Protection Agency, said Aguilera, a postdoctoral scholar at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. The problem with the standard is it doesn't account for different sources of emissions of PM2.5. As of now, there is not a consensus as to why wildfire PM2.5 is more harmful to humans than other sources of particulate pollution. If PM2.5 from wildfires is more dangerous to human lungs than that of ambient air pollution, the threshold for what is considered safe levels of PM2.5 should reflect the source of the particles, especially during the expanding wildfire season. This is especially relevant in California and other regions where most PM2.5 is expected to come from wildfires. Okay, and another air pollution news, this from Science Daily. California's diesel emissions rules reduce air pollution, protect vulnerable communities. Extending California's stringent diesel emission standards to the rest of the U.S. could dramatically improve the nation's air quality and health, particularly in lower-income communities of color, finds a new analysis published in the journal Science. Since 1990, California has used its authority under the Federal Clean Air Act to enact more aggressive rules on emissions from diesel vehicles and engines compared to the rest of the U.S. These policies, crafted by the California Air Resources Board, have helped the state reduce diesel emissions by 78% between 1990 and 2014, while diesel emissions in the rest of the U.S. dropped by just 51% during the same time period. The study estimates that by 2014, improved air quality cut the annual number of diesel-related cardiopulmonary deaths in the state in half, compared to the number of deaths that would have occurred in California if California had followed the same trajectory as the rest of the U.S. Adopting similar rules nationwide could produce the same kinds of benefits, particularly for communities that have suffered the worst impacts of air pollution. Everybody benefits from cleaner air, but we see time and time again that it's predominantly lower-income communities of color that are living and working in close proximity to sources of air pollution, like freight yards, highways, and ports. When you target these sources, it's the highly exposed communities that stand to benefit most, said study lead author Megan Schwartzman, a physician in environmental health science at the University of California, Berkeley's School of Public Health. It's about time because these communities have suffered a disproportionate burden of harm. The study reports that every dollar the state has spent controlling air pollution has generated $38 in benefits attributable to lower rates of illness, premature death, and lost productivity attributable to air pollution. As a result, there is no reason why the U.S. as a whole shouldn't adopt diesel emission standards similar to California's. In terms of public health, federal air quality policy should be moving towards that of California because we've shown that it works, and we've also shown that greening transportation can be good for economic growth. These environmental regulations not only save lives and improve public health, they actually drive innovation and grow the green economy, which is the future. Okay, and continuing on environmental health and environmental justice, this from The Hill. EPA head, COVID-19 created a perfect storm for environmental justice communities. The new Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan pledged to address the disparate impacts of pollution on underserved communities, saying the need to address environmental justice has only become more urgent as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. In a virtual fireside chat at the 2021 CERES conference, Regan said that under his leadership, the agency will explore the question of what does real change look like in underserved communities. Environmental justice is near and dear to my heart, he said, adding that COVID-19 created a perfect storm for environmental justice communities. Regan has a background in such issues specifically, having created North Carolina's Environmental Justice and Equity Board in 2018 during his previous position as the head of the state's Department of Environmental Quality. We will be driven by our conviction that every person in our great country has the right to clean air, clean water, and a healthier life, no matter how much money they have in their pockets, the color of their skin, or the community that they live in, Regan said in December when then-President-elect Biden introduced him as his EPA nominee. More from the Biden administration, this from the Associated Press, Biden EPA to reconsider Trump rule on lead in drinking water. The Biden administration said it was delaying the effective date of a policy intended to prevent lead pollution of drinking water, continuing a decades-old debate over how to remove a serious health hazard to children. The EPA said it was suspending a regulatory rewrite completed by the Trump administration in December, which is being challenged in court by numerous states and advocacy groups. The agency hasn't decided whether to seek changes, but wants to review the revised rule, take public input, and consult with affected parties. Critics contend the new measure is weak and gives public utilities too long to replace aging, lead-tainted pipes, such as those that contaminated drinking water in Flint, Michigan. The Trump administration's overhaul requires utilities to test water at schools and daycare centers and disclose the location of lead-containing service lines, which run from main water pipes to homes. It also toughens testing procedures. But environmental groups said it would give water systems up to 33 years to replace an estimated 6 million remaining lead service lines, instead of 14 years under the previous rule. The Biden administration's proposed delay is a positive sign that the agency is finally going to get serious about strengthening the regulations, said Eric Olson, Senior Strategic Director of Health with the National Resources Defense Council, one of the groups that sued EPA in federal court over the Trump policy. It's about time we saw action to fix this scourge that has been with us for more than 100 years of contaminated water across the country. And in Biden administration healthcare news, this from The Hill. Biden administration extends special Obamacare enrollment until August. The Biden administration announced it's expanding the special pandemic enrollment period for Obamacare plans for 3 additional months until August 15th. The move means signups on the healthcare.gov website will remain open for the majority of 2021. New and current enrollees will have an additional 3 months to enroll in coverage or change their plans, and to have access to additional subsidies from the American Rescue Plan that could make coverage cheaper. Most states that operate their own exchanges have also extended open enrollment, which is typically available only for qualifying life events such as getting married, a job loss, or a move. The additional financial assistance will become available starting April 1st. As a result of the law, premiums will be capped at the maximum of 8.5% of income, down from about 10%. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, costs will drop by an average of $50 per person per month and $85 per policy per month. People who make more than 400% of the federal poverty level, about $100,000 for a family of four, will become eligible for financial assistance for the first time, helping prevent them from having to pay full freight for their plans. About 80% of people will be able to find plans for $10 or less after subsidies, up from 69% before the American Rescue Plan. On average, one out of four enrollees on healthcare.gov will be able to upgrade to a higher plan category that offers better out-of-pocket costs at the same or lower premium compared to what they're paying today. People who are currently enrolled in an Obamacare plan who may want to take advantage of the additional subsidies will need to go back to healthcare.gov after April 1st and update their applications to get that additional financial help. However, the administration noted that when a consumer changes plans, the amount they've already paid towards meeting their prior plan's deductible and annual limit on cost sharing may be reset to zero, meaning it would need to start over paying the out-of-pocket expenses. Okay, in news related to the single most preventable cause of death in the U.S., cigarette smoking. This from Medical Express. Starting smoking cessation in hospitalized patients would reduce many premature deaths. Smoking cigarettes causes 480,000 premature deaths each year in the United States, due mainly to a 2-fold risk of cardiovascular disease and a 20-fold risk of lung cancer. Although smoking rates have declined dramatically, there are currently 35 million smokers in the U.S. In a commentary published in the Ochsner Medical Journal, Dr. Charles Hennekins and colleagues highlight how failure to institute smoking cessation in hospitalized patients is a missed opportunity to avoid many premature deaths. Each year in the U.S., approximately 30 million hospitalizations occur in individuals 18 and older. Of these, more than 7 million are current cigarette smokers, whose average hospital stay is several days. The authors comment that starting smoking cessation therapy during hospitalization and maintaining high adherence post-discharge can markedly improve permanent quit rates in these patients with minimal to no side effects. Smoking cessation therapy also should include long-term counseling and at least 90 days of prescription drug, in particular, varenicline, which works by blocking the pleasurable sensations of nicotine on the brain. Providing multifactorial intensive counseling interventions during and after hospitalization and initiating and maintaining adherence to drug therapies are all independent predictors of permanent smoking cessation rates, says Hennekins. All of these efforts have the potential to reduce many premature deaths from cigarette smoking, which remain alarmingly and unnecessarily high in the U.S. and has already become so worldwide. Quitting smoking reduces the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease, beginning with a matter of months, reaching that of a lifelong non-smoker within a few years, even among older adults. In contrast, reductions in mortality risk from lung cancer only begin to appear several years after quitting, And even by 10 years, the risk is reduced to only approximately midway between continuing smokers and lifelong smokers. This is because the risk of cardiovascular disease relates to the numbers of cigarettes currently smoked and the risk of cancer to the duration of the habit. And in more smoking news, this regarding health inequities from the New York Times, menthol cigarettes kill many black people. A ban may finally be near. The banning of menthol cigarettes, the mint-flavored products that have been aggressively marketed to black Americans, has long been an elusive goal for public health regulators. But COVID-19 and the Black Lives Matter movement have put new pressure on Congress and the White House to reduce racial health disparities. And there are few starker examples than this. Black smokers smoke less but die of heart attacks, strokes, and other causes linked to tobacco use at higher rates than white smokers do, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And 85% of black smokers use Newport, Kool, and other menthol brands that are easier to become addicted to and harder to quit than plain tobacco, according to the FDA. There is now growing momentum in Congress to enact a ban. In states and municipalities across the country, black public health activists have been organizing support and getting new laws passed at the state and local level. Public opposition among white parents to all flavored e-cigarettes, including menthol, has brought a new resource to the issue. And the FDA is under a court order to respond to a citizen's petition to ban menthol by April 29th. Advocates are hoping that President Biden, whose campaign had strong support from black voters and who has put addressing health inequities front and center among his goals, will soon come out in favor of the ban. I have no doubt that it's time for a ban on menthol, said Representative Karen Bass of California, who led the Congressional Black Caucus during the last Congress. We should never allow a chemical that is specifically targeted to a population that increases death, no matter who it is. In this case, it's menthol in the black population. I am so excited that we have an administration that puts racial equity and health disparities at the top of its agenda. And for you smokers out there, just as a reminder, in Ohio, there is a free smoking quit line that you can access to get advice, help, and referrals. That is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, here's a story on bias in our healthcare system. This from Medical Express. Study reveals bias among doctors who classify x-rays for coal miners' black lung claims. University of Illinois Chicago researchers are the first to report on the financial conflicts of interest that exist among doctors who review the chest x-rays of coal miners who file workers' compensation claims of totally disabling disease with the U.S. Department of Labor's Federal Black Lung Program. The University of Illinois Chicago researchers found that the determinations of these doctors, who are known as B readers and who are certified by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, were strongly associated with the party that hired them. By analyzing almost 64,000 radiographic classifications made by 264 physicians in the Black Lung Program claims filed during 2000 to 2013, the researchers found that B readers who were identified as ever being hired by a coal miner's employer read the images as negative for pneumoconiosis, black lung disease, in 85% of the records. Pneumoconiosis is the general term for a class of lung diseases caused by the inhalation of dust. Coal workers' pneumoconiosis, or CWP, is commonly known as black lung disease and caused by long-term inhalation of coal dust. Comparatively, a lower percentage of the records were read as negative for the disease by those hired by the Department of Labor or a miner, either 63% if you're hired by the Department of Labor or 51% if you're hired by the miner. Okay, now that's a lot of data, and as a science journalist, I would just like to reinterpret those numbers a little bit. So basically, those that are hired by the coal companies, the physicians identified 15% as a positive for black lung disease. Those that were hired by the Department of Labor identified 37%, which is means it's 2.4 times less likely that an x-ray would be read as positive for black lung disease if it was if you were hired by the coal, if the coal miner was the employer, if the doctor was hired by the coal miner's employer. Okay, the authors write that given the clear association between classifications and financial conflicts of interest, a lack of consistency in classifications within and between B readers, and an absence of an objective gold standard for chest x-ray classifications, substantial improvements in transparency, oversight, and objectivity for black lung claims are clearly needed. It is clear from this data that this bias is a systemic problem, and the most significant offenders are identifiable. The records show a clear pattern of B-reader conflicts of interest. Better utilizing the current regulations to decertify B-readers with a significant bias are among the recommendations the authors of the study present in the paper. The authors also recommend that all initial contact and payment should be made by the U.S. Department of Labor, and the other party should be prohibited from communicating on a claim until the initial classifications are submitted, limiting coordination between the reader and the requester. The author said other methods to reduce bias should include growing and diversifying the pool of B-readers, regulating the fees of B-readers who testify on behalf of either party, mandating B-readers to disclose any wholesale relationships and their associated income from related classifications, and investing in scientific advances that leverage artificial intelligence to classify chess films without bias. The technology is there, but we don't have the systems in place to validate or implement a process. It's a matter of motivation. This is really just the tip of the iceberg. It is very likely that the issue extends beyond the federal Black Lung Program and is pervasive across workers' compensation systems. Okay, well, last up, and what may be the death certificate of the notion that each generation will be healthier or wealthier than the previous generation, this from Science Daily. Health declining in Gen X and Gen Y, U.S. study shows. Recent generations show a worrying decline in health compared to their parents and grandparents when they were the same age, a new national study reveals. Researchers found that compared to previous generations, members of Generation X and Generation Y show poor physical health, higher levels of unhealthy behavior such as alcohol use and smoking, and more depression and anxiety. The results suggest the likelihood of higher levels of disease and more deaths in younger generations than we have seen in the past, said Hu Zheng, lead author of the study and professor of sociology at The Ohio State University. The worsening health profiles we found in Gen X and Gen Y is alarming. If we don't find a way to slow this trend, we are potentially going to see an expansion of morbidity and mortality rates in the United States as these generations get older. Okay, well, end the show here with a segment on bonus articles. So you can go online and read any of these articles at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And I'll repeat that at the end of it. So we got five of them here. One, many QAnon followers report having mental health diagnoses. Perhaps not a surprise. Far-right extremists move from stop the steal to stop the vaccine. Third, vaccine passports are on the way, but developing them won't be easy, the one I referenced earlier in the show. And fourthly, a user's guide, how to talk to those hesitant about the COVID-19 vaccine. And lastly, but not least, My Shot, a song adapted from the hit Broadway show Hamilton. My Shot addresses the social, scientific, and political issues currently affecting the decision to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. So if you want to see a remake, sort of a parody, but in a positive way, of a hit Broadway show song, then listen to My Shot. Go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT for the link. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.